Problems
and of the causes of religious, philosophical,
and racial antagonisms.
That is our mission.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Good afternoon, friends. Good afternoon, and welcome to this week's edition of The Lawyer's Campaign. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host and friend, Maria Hall. Maria, we've got a good show again for folks this week. Let them know what they're in for if they stay tuned, and I hope they do.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Yes, well, today we'll be speaking with our friend, constitutional scholar Stephen Rohde, about the Supreme Court term that just ended, which may indeed be remembered as one of the most consequential in modern constitutional history, signaling a shift in the balance of government powers. Then, in our second half hour, we'll be speaking with Professor Stephanie Kuntz about the many changes to the roles we all play in our families and how those institutions, the institution of marriage, the idea of family life, all of that is changing and evolving, so we can't wait to speak with her.
Well, good. Let's get us going. I think we start with Steve Rohde, don't we?
Yes, absolutely. Well, to help us make sense of the developments with the Supreme Court, we are joined by our good friend, constitutional scholar, author, and longtime civil liberties advocate, Stephen Rohde. He is the author of two books and numerous articles. He is so prolific, as well as book reviews on constitutional law and history. He's the former president of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California and is special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. He's also host of a podcast, Speaking Freely, produced by Ms. Studios, and along with Jim Lafferty and myself, is a co-host of the national public affairs show called Law and Disorder, now airing on close to 200 radio markets in the U.S. Steve Rohde, welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Maria, thank you so much. I'm grateful to be with you and Jim again.
Yes. Well, okay, let's talk about this unitary executive theory. Once again, you've talked to us a little bit about it here and there, but tell us, you've written that this theory poses a grave danger to the U.S. Constitution and separation of government powers. How has the court employed that doctrine, and why is it such a threat to our constitutional system?
Well, thank you. And I'm taking the time today to dig deep into this last Supreme Court term by looking really at trends, at the emergence of different theories that this conservative court is using to really dismantle our constitutional republic. The theme for today is that this is a captured court. Captured courts is a concept. It emerged back in 2018 in some writings because it looked internationally at courts in Poland, courts in Hungary, and elsewhere, and now courts in the United States. And I believe captured court is a just and appropriate label for the U.S. Supreme Court in this moment. I think it's a willing captured court. No judges on the majority are fighting this. This is in line with their own political agenda and that six-member solid right-wing conservative majority is marching through the Republican agenda. It's been doing this for 20 years. Now it's doing the bidding of Project 2025. Underlying it are two doctrines we're going to talk about at the beginning of this show, and the first is the unitary executive theory. This was a concept developed during the Reagan years, along with some law reviews by conservative professors, Robert Bork. Many will remember his attempt at being elevated to the U.S. Supreme Court that was blocked largely because of his regressive views. And the unitary executive theory was a notion that the president of the United States sits atop the entire federal government. He, or maybe someday she, is in total control of all the executive branch, but likewise, therefore, cannot be intruded upon by either Congress or the courts. This marginal conservative theory began to gain sway and ultimately has seized the majority of the Supreme Court. And the cases we're going to talk about today will illustrate that fact and in a way demonstrate that this court is really working against the U.S. Constitution. Let's remember that the Constitution sets out the president's duties and powers. In Article 2, Section 3, of course, the main power is the president shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. That's what the executive branch is about. It's executing laws that have been duly passed by the most democratic branch of our government, Congress, the House of Representatives, and the Senate. It's been little noted that there's another section that describes the president's responsibilities. One of them we do know, to give to the Congress information of the State of the Union. And that's the famous State of the Union address we get every year. But that provision goes on, and it says something that I believe commentators and even law professors and others are paying very little attention to. The Constitution says the president shall recommend to Congress's consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. Recommend laws. So how can you get from a constitution that says the president will recommend laws and he shall execute laws into this notion through the unitary executive theory that he dominates and totally controls the executive branch without any oversight by Congress or the courts? That's what we're facing right now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Well, a second conservative doctrine, of course, it's a very conservative court we've got now. What the majority is using is this doctrine of originalism, Steve. What is originalism and how is it being used to further the conservative agenda?
This is another one of those doctrines, again, cooked up in the 1980s by law professors. It was embraced by Justice Antonin Scalia. He was often in the minority or in dissent by himself in the early days. It suggests that the way to interpret the Constitution is only to look at the words, the text, and the intention of the founders in 1787, or with the amendments, including the 14th Amendment, to look at the drafters of that amendment at the time it was adopted in the 19th century. This is a very convenient doctrine. It freezes the Constitution in the 18th and 19th centuries. It works very nicely for conservatives who want to prevent the expansion of constitutional rights. It's at war with the notion that we have a living Constitution that sets forth certain fundamental principles, but the application of those principles expands to meet ever new threats to constitutional rights. And so the court in this originalism theory, it is no longer Scalia's. It is Scalia's dream. He died several years ago, and now the six-member conservative majority are all loyal originalists. Well, they're loyal originalists when it favors them to go back and look at the origins of the Constitution, when they want to limit gun rights, or when they claim there was no right to abortion in the early Constitution. But boy, as we will see today, they will abandon originalism like a hot potato when it's inconvenient to their conservative Republican agenda. And we saw that on full display this term.
Well, Steve, last week, there was an opinion piece in SCOTUS blog by Christopher Coons, David Beyer, and Ray Brescia called "The Supreme Court's Quiet Coup." And that may sound dramatic, but how does that piece relate to the concepts you've been discussing?
Yeah, it's hardly overstating it. That's what a captured court is doing. They're dressing up decisions in legalese and legal terms, but they are committing a coup because the Roberts Court is systematically stripping away power from Congress, which is the most directly elected branch of our government. The erosion of constitutional authority isn't happening by accident. It's a direct result of a steady, calculated intrusion into Congress's constitutionally designated role. And it has been instrumental in what Roberts for 20 years has been doing. He has led the court in radically narrowing Congress's ability to shape how laws are interpreted, implemented, and defended. But Congress and the people must not take these intrusions laying down. And there's a hopeful piece to my conversation today that to a large extent, there are powers resting with Congress to address these issues, as well as the people. I want to mention briefly in this section how the court has weakened voting rights. I mean, these voting rights, the Voting Rights Act, was originally passed with strong bipartisan support. So that's Congress speaking for the people, five separate occasions by overwhelming congressional majorities. The Voting Rights Act has been ratified and renewed. But in blatant disregard, back in an early case called Shelby County versus Holder in 2013, Justice Roberts eliminated a section which allowed the DOJ to supervise changes in elections in those states that had a history of racial discrimination. And then just a few months ago in Louisiana versus Calais, the court explicitly rejected the legislatively crafted framework used to challenge racially discriminatory voting practices. Now, what's so shocking is members of Congress had carefully weighed competing interests to secure a bipartisan compromise for the Voting Rights Act. They had carefully created a legislative record to that effect, and the Roberts Court simply swept all of that away. And secondly, quickly, and we'll discuss this in detail, our administrative agencies. It's the second way that the Roberts Court is intruding on Congress. Congress has created agencies like the Federal Trade Commission. And instead, the Roberts Court has invented legal doctrines. One is known as the Major Questions Doctrine. They just invented this concept that if Congress doesn't use the magic words to delegate certain powers to these administrative agencies, then the court can step in and decide whether those administrative agencies possess those powers and can exercise them. They've marched through those cases, and they did it this term in a case called Trump versus Slaughter, which I'll discuss in more detail later. This is why there is a judicial coup taking place, and it's going to rest with the people and Congress to take back the Constitution.
I mean, not content with all that you've mentioned already, they damn near tried to rewrite the Constitution with the 14th Amendment case this time in a 5-4 decision, something they have absolutely no right to do, which is rewrite the Constitution. Well, at any rate, Steve, how do the American people feel about all this? There's been a poll, a new poll found that, in fact, at least half of adult citizens in the United States disapprove of the way the Supreme Court is handling its docket. Talk to us a bit about those findings.
Yes, I wanted to highlight this early in the program because it speaks to my notion of the role that the American people can play. The Supreme Court is not some lofty institution beyond our reach. And a lot of this polling shows the attitude of Americans to this court. The poll initially found that half of Americans somewhat or strongly disapprove of the way the court is handling its job. Only 36% approve of the Supreme Court's handling of its job. Now, Democrats, it's no surprise, overwhelmingly disapprove of the Supreme Court's handling its job, 80% to 12% approval. But the share of independents who disapprove of the Supreme Court is about twice as large as those who approve. The majority of Republicans, 69%, approve of the current court, which only ratifies the notion that the court is discharging the MAGA agenda, and it's making those Republicans very happy. Nearly half, 45%, think the court's decisions have given the president too much power. Only 38% think those decisions have been correct. Most Americans say the president should not be able to fire members of the Federal Reserve Board or other agencies. On the issue of immigration, the majority, 56% of Americans agree with the court's recent decision that all children born in the U.S. should be citizens regardless of their parents' immigration status. Let's pause on that one. It's only 56%. It's only 6% above a majority that believe that the 14th Amendment means it when it says that every person born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof is a citizen upon birth. Mm-hmm. There were other findings that disagreed with the court on immigration, deportation, and other issues as well. So the reason I emphasize this is because we need to run against the Supreme Court. We would have large majorities of the American public, those views that I've just summarized. We can target these conservative decisions as being both contrary to the Constitution itself and out of step with the American people. And three of those justices were appointed by Donald Trump. Now, as the constitutional scholar you expect me to be, there is a caution. We need to remind ourselves that when it comes to minority rights, and especially the right to protest and express views that the majority disagrees with, we don't want the court to follow the popularity polls and deny those constitutional rights. Those are rights that the minority enjoys, and one of the jobs of the court is to protect those rights. So I'm always a little cautious about rallying around public opinion when it comes to the court. I do believe on those broad policy issues, that's the right view. But let's be careful, because we don't want the court reading the popularity polls when it comes to unpopular speech or the right to protest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Steve, the Supreme Court justices themselves have been particularly divided on many decisions, even on issues I wouldn't have thought would be controversial, like birthright citizenship, which you were just discussing. Talk about this, please.
Yes, they sometimes disagree, and then they will find loopholes. And this is the moment to briefly look at Trump v. Barbara, which was the birthright citizenship case. This is a case of abandoning originalism. You know, you look at the Constitution. Originalists would look at the 14th Amendment, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens. What Trump did a couple years ago, he invented this notion that all persons didn't apply to children born here in the United States whose parents were undocumented. And he seized, and his lawyers seized on that phrase, subject to the jurisdiction thereof. They converted that into a loyalty oath. Somehow these babies need to pledge loyalty to the United States or they're not subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And that was literally the argument made by Trump's lawyers. What's shocking is that four U.S. Supreme Court justices bought it. This case has been badly covered in some of the mainstream media as a welcome case of Roberts upholding the Constitution. No, we came within one vote of the entire 14th Amendment being trashed. And we know that that provision was written to overcome the Dred Scott case in 1857. It's been consistently upheld throughout the history of the court. It is a classic originalist position, and yet those four right-wing justices were only too happy to throw it over in order to give greater power to Trump and to diminish the rights of those children born in the United States. We've got to face the fact that we're only one vote away from losing that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, a bright spot, at least from the Lawyers Guild's point of view, certainly is the court has been Ketanji Brown Jackson, Justice Jackson. It's her third year on the court. The Supreme Court term ending July 30th was her third year. Now, she hasn't been shy, has she, about making her opinions known. What can you tell us about her personality on the court and what she seems to be fighting for and what she's fighting against?
When they write the history of the Roberts Court, chapters will be devoted to the three dissenters, mm-hmm. The dissents of Ketanji Brown Jackson, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan will go down in the annals. They have spoken truth to power. They've described for the public the right side of the law and the Constitution in these cases. But there's one technical area that I will risk taking a few minutes to discuss, and that is Justice Jackson's approach to the interpretation of laws passed by Congress. The conservatives have taken up what is called textualism. You know, what originalism is to the Constitution, textualism is to congressional legislation. They just want to look at the words on the paper, and if those words are ambiguous or uncertain, those justices will then supply the meaning based on their judicial philosophy and political agenda. But Justice Jackson and many justices before her, she builds this work on Stephen Breyer and David Souter and John Paul Stevens and others. She says, no, if there's ambiguity, let's look at what Congress intended. Let's look at the congressional reports, the testimony, the statements in Congress, the committee reports, and the like. The conservatives despise that. They don't want to examine what Congress intended. They're happy to see ambiguity in statutes because then they can fill in the interstices themselves with their political and legal agenda. She has spoken clearly on this. She is beginning to have an impact because Justice Amy Coney Barrett began not going as far as Justice Jackson to see the value of why, if you're trying to interpret a statute, you would look at what the Congress persons intended and the legislative history. I'm noting this today It'll be on the final exam next month for your listeners. But I delved into a legal concept because I think it's worth understanding, and we can see where Justice Jackson is valiantly trying to move the court back to respecting Congress and the intent of Congress.
Indeed.
Well, in the June 29th Trump versus Slaughter decision, the court gave Trump broad power to fire the commissioners who had been serving on what used to be called independent federal agencies. So what did Trump do? He immediately got rid of all of the commissioners on the Elections Assistance Commission. Tell us about that.
Well, if you thought these decisions didn't matter, it didn't take a week for Trump to exercise his brand new powers confirmed by his handpicked court in choosing to give this power to the president to fire these commissioners. The Election Assistance Commission is a body. It has been in existence since about 2016. 2002. It was a reaction to the Florida recount episode. We'll all remember the hanging chads. It's a substantial agency that works on a relatively small $24 million budget. It generally views election, it assists election administrators. It provides guardrails for elections in the country. And it has done its job through various Democratic and Republican administrations for quite some time. Instead, when he had his new powers granted to him by the conservative court, Trump terminated immediately Thomas Hicks and Benjamin Hovland, two members of this commission chosen by Democrats to serve on the Election Assistance Commission, and he, quote, accepted the resignation of a Republican member, Christy McCormick. An earlier member had previously resigned in the spring. There are no members on this commission today as we enter into the midterm elections. This is because the court, rejecting originalism and stare decisis, the notion that you must follow precedent, they overturned a 91-year-old unanimous Supreme Court case called Humphrey's Executor, which said that Congress could place limits on the president's power to fire individuals. The FTC, the president under the law written by Congress, could only fire them for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. The Supreme Court has struck that down. They've ignored history, they've ignored precedent, and as a result, they are now marching, they are allowing Trump to march through these administrative agencies. And I predict we're going to see a lot more of this. And it's the very practical impact of these decisions. They don't sit on a dusty shelf, and it's we the people, it's Congress. Some of these can be overturned by Congress, making its intentions clearer even to these conservatives. And it is rest with the people, because we elect Congress, we elect the Senate, and we elect the President of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, indeed. Well, that's it for today, I think, right, Steve?
Yes, we did it in a half hour.
We did it in a half an hour, as always. You're right on time. Well, we can take an early station identification break. Our next guest is already ready, so we'll turn to her a few minutes early. Let's take a brief station ID break, and don't go anywhere, friends. We'll be right back with you.
The wild-eyed boys that had been away haven't changed, had much to say. But man, I still think them cats are crazy. They were asking if you were around, how you was, where you could be found. Told them you were living downtown, driving all the old men crazy. The boys are back in town, the boys are back in town. I said, the boys are back in town.
Hey. Just so you know, we'll happily accept your car, your records, you know, old LPs, your stock, and yes, even that shoebox of cables in the garage. We're not picky. We're people-powered radio. KPFK.org/give.
This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics and author of Parallel Worlds and Hyperspace. And whenever I'm in Los Angeles, I tune into my favorite radio station, KPFK 90.7 on your FM dial.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
Well, as promised, we are right back with you. You're still listening to the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host Maria Hall. And in this segment of the show, well, let me tell you what we're going to cover. It's not surprising, really, that over the past 250 years of American life, the nature of the American family and the nature of marriage, marriage laws, and, well, the roles of women and men in marriage and family have undergone some profound changes. And we're going to explore some of those changes today here on the Lawyers Guild Show. And to do so, we're fortunate to have as our guest someone who may well be the leading expert on the matter in the country today. She is Professor Stephanie Kuntz. Professor Kuntz is the Director of Research and Public Education Council on Contemporary Families and Professor Emerita at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. The author of numerous books on today's topic. Her latest book is entitled For Better and Worse, The Complicated Past and Challenging Future of Marriage. Well, Professor Stephanie Kuntz, a warm welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show, my friend.
Well, thank you.
Now, Stephanie, there are certainly a good many conflicting views on marriage. The Heritage Foundation and others say we must revive marriage as the route to social stability and personal success, versus the argument that marriage is inherently oppressive of women and enforces heteronormativity. That's a mouthful of a word. Talk to us about all of this.
Well, I never use the word heteronormativity in my writing, but that's what some people say about it. It's funny that we start with this because when the Supreme Court issued its decision on legalizing same-sex marriage, I was, in fact, delighted and really surprised when people started calling me saying, oh, they cited your book in it. And then I read how they cited my book, which was with Kennedy talking about how marriage had always conferred honor and nobility and everybody. And I have spent the last 30 years explaining that for thousands of years, marriage did nothing of the kind, yes. That it was extremely oppressive to women. But I don't think, I think the evidence suggests that that's not how marriage originated. When you look in our Paleolithic ancestors, it didn't originate to protect women, nor did it originate to oppress women. That's probably about as equal as people have gotten in the past. Marriage really originated in order to get in-laws. It was a way of making connections with other bands, of expanding your obligations to others and extending them through time with the kids that arrived. So I think that there's plenty of evidence that marriage does not have to be heteronormative. In fact, many of band-level societies allowed people of different biological sexes to take on the role of a different gender and had no problem with it. Sometimes they said, you have to take that on completely, but at other times they specifically honored people who were able to draw on the roles that in their society were assigned to both men and women. So, but it's true that for thousands of years, of course, marriage was oppressive, and we can even see hangovers in that today. And that's of course why I wrote my book. But I have become concerned about this idea that it's inherently oppressive. When one of the things that we find is that, yes, it has been for years. And in fact, all of these people who say that marriage is, they look at the averages, people on average are happier when they're in a marriage. But mostly that's because they can get out of a bad marriage. You know, here in California, when Reagan signed the first bill saying that you could have unilateral divorce, even you didn't have to prove fault, you could get out of it. Before that, you had to not only prove fault, you guys probably knew this, but I was just stunned when I realized that most of the divorce laws around America said you had to be without fault yourself. Yes. So there were cases where they would come in and they would find that both of them behaved very badly, but they had to stay together because they were both miserable and they were both equally bad. To get back to the point of Reagan signing that no-fault divorce, we had, as a result, almost a controlled study of what happens when, in the first 5 years, when people have the right to leave a marriage without jumping through all these hoops. And what we found is divorce rates did go up. They have fallen since. But also in that first 5 years, wives' suicide rates declined by 30%, and domestic violent reports declined by a quarter to a half. So obviously, getting out, being able to get out of a bad marriage is a good thing. Yeah. And it is true that marriage, though, has a lot of benefits. And I've been concerned by the extent to which people have become pessimistic about it. So I think those are some of the things we'll continue to talk about. Yes. But I think that it's important to know that there are some leftovers. For example, we know that when heterosexual couples who are living together or cohabiting break up, it's gender neutral who initiates the breakup. But when married couples break up, it is almost overwhelmingly the woman who initiates it. And I think that's because of a lot of the leftover habits and assumptions that we've inherited. And that's what I wrote my book to do, is to talk about how we can and should get rid of those leftover habits and institutions and expectations.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so interesting. Stephanie, where does the country now stand on marriage? I understand that marriage rates have reached new lows, for example, and people are much more accepting of, say, living together or divorce. Is marriage becoming obsolete, do you think?
I don't think so. Most people want to end up in a marriage or a marriage-like relationship. And most people do still eventually get married a lot later than they used to. Two-thirds of people who divorce go ahead and get married again. So there's this idea that people have forgotten, you know, one of my students once wrote in a paper that people nowadays don't respect the marriage vows, which I just love the vowels, I-O-U, you know. But the fact is that when you take polls in Europe and America, most people say that marriage is the strongest, highest commitment that they can imagine. Only 6 to 8% of individuals under 35 say that they don't want to get married, for sure, and that's gay or straight individuals. But what we're seeing is that many, many people are more uncertain about whether they should marry. When we look at polls of high school seniors, since about 2019, there's been this huge drop, and especially among women, which is the opposite of the way it used to be, of in people saying that they fully expect to marry. They're not saying they don't expect to, but they're saying, I don't have any idea. I'm not sure. And I think that uncertainty about marriage is one of the things that we really need to talk about and understand better. But it's, I think, accompanied by the fact, we get a clue to it when we see that what the other big change in the poll responses of high school seniors is that they're much less likely than even 10 years ago to say they're very confident that they'll be a great partner, a very good partner. So I think what we're coming to is we've got higher aspirations for marriage than ever before. We actually we have higher standards for what we expect of ourselves and our partner. For the first time ever, we really want to organize marriages that are free from coercion by parents, from the state, you know, from rigid rules about who can marry and who can divorce and what you have to do in a marriage. But those high aspirations clash both with the historically entrenched habits and expectations, but also with changing intensifying socioeconomic problems that create new risks along with new rewards and new uncertainty about whether we're going to be able to make marriage work.
Hmm. Well, Stephanie, in the last chapter of your recent book, and again, that book is For Better and Worse, The Complicated Past and Challenging Future of Marriage. But in the last chapter, you write about current marriage issues. But before that, you zero in on five distinct historical periods when very different marriage and gender norms prevailed. What were those periods, and why did you choose them to write about?
Well, I chose ones that have very, very different ideas about how marriage should be organized, going back to hunting-gathering societies and then the development of unequal patriarchal societies, and then looking, for example, at the way patriarchal aristocratic societies operated, like England and colonial America versus the early democratic ones. Each of those has been so... And then, of course, the 1920s, where we had a cultural war just really very similar to the one we've had today, because it was changing so much the ideals. And then in the 1950s. So I wanted to go in and show how tremendously variable these relationships were and these ideas that we take for granted. We tend to think that people have always felt the same way about love, about sex, about what men do, about what women do. And the fact is, they haven't.
Hmm.
Wow. Well, can you give us some examples of variations in gender norms or marital ideals that might surprise people today?
Well, gosh, there are so many. I suppose one of the biggest ones is this idea of masculinity, of what masculinity is. Now, men have always been dominant, but in many societies, class outweighed gender. The idea, for example, that... you remember when Hillary Clinton was running for president, a couple of guys would show up at her rallies with signs like "Shine my shoes." Well, I'll tell you, nobody in a patriarchal society, aristocratic, would dare of the lower classes act that way to an upper class woman. So the ideals of masculinity too that we have are quite recent. If you go back to a lot of the people who nowadays are part of the manosphere, I think would think that most of the men they read about in history are total wusses. You know, hand them a Tampax. You get to the medieval ages and the Song of Roland. When the hero Roland dies, 20,000 knights faint and cry and then faint with sadness and fall off their horses. when you get to the late 18th century and the early 19th century, we have letters from men just pouring their hearts out, not just to women, but to other men, saying to them, it actually sounds like the letters that I used to write as a girl, you know, to my girlfriends, like, I miss you so much. And, you know, I wish you were here and I'd give you a big hug. We run across letters, for example, from a man to his fiancée saying that he had fallen peacefully to sleep last night on the bosom of his roommate. And it was such a nice sleep, but never thought that this was anything wrong with it. As late as the early 20th century, some men were still taking pictures. When the camera was invented in the mid 19th century, we have dozens and hundreds, actually, of pictures of men who would take pictures of themselves sitting on the lap of their best friend. You know, which nowadays, you know, people would be mortified for. So this idea that masculinity has to be hard that way and is not emotional is absolutely false. And the other kind of thing that you find, another important thing in the past that's different, is women didn't used to be responsible for emotion work. The lower classes used to be responsible for emotion work. You know, if you were lower of status, you watched very carefully what someone higher status, male or female, was thinking and feeling, and you worked around to make sure that they stayed in a good mood, just as women have been told to do today. So there are all of these, you know, really interesting changes that I think can help us shake up our ideas of how it has to be. Let me just give you one more example. I don't want to talk, you know, rattle on too long about it. But the opposite of manhood in America used to be not womanhood, but boyhood. The idea was you grow into maturity. The opposite of a man was a boy. The opposite of a child was a man. It's not until the kind of late 19th century that you get the idea that the opposite of manhood is womanhood. And I think part of it may be related to the development of a new imperialism and a more competitive robber baron society, but also I think to the fact that as women were entering new professions and getting new rights that had originally the men were confident in having, some men found themselves feeling like they had to prove that they were very different from women. And that desire to prove that has been, I think, really bad for both sexes. Because when you think about it, I think the fact that women can now do so many of the things that men used to have a monopoly on and act in ways that, you know, as brave people, as, you know, as heroes, may have left some men feeling that being toxic is the only way that they can prove that they're not feminine.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stephanie, let's talk as well about some more contemporary issues. And I'm thinking about the book you wrote in 1992. You wrote a book called The Way We Never Were, The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap. But you say in a recent LA Times op-ed piece that you wrote that you've changed your understanding of nostalgia in that context. How so?
Well, I certainly haven't begun to be more sympathetic to marriages of the 1950s. This was a period when marital rape was perfectly legal in every state. Child abuse was more frequent than it is today. The marriages were extremely unfair. There were very much higher rates of domestic violence, and that was much more accepted. Even prominent psychologists would talk about wife beating as a possibly good way of reestablishing normality in a relationship, because the man was able then to reassert himself, and the woman could feel punished for what she would felt guilty about her masculinity. I mean, the 1950s are nothing to be nostalgic about for families. But where I've changed my mind is that as we've seen the last 25 years develop, I've begun to realize that the only thing, you know, more dangerous than indulging nostalgia for the 50s is ignoring the actual legitimate grievances that underlie it. And of course, a lot of those are economic, that some things about the 1950s were pretty good, you know, just the economics of it. From 1947 to 1973, every cohort of 25 to 35-year-old men were making three times as much as their father had made before them. That's kind of different than today. They could buy a home on an average of two times their national. And every economic expansion between the late 1940s and 1969 saw two-thirds of the income growth go to the bottom 90% of the population. Mm-hmm. And in fact, actually, recently, two RAND economists mentioned that if those trends had continued, every single section of the bottom 90% of the population, black and white, low wage, medium wage, would have ended up by 2018 earning almost 70% more than they did. Wow. But who got that 70% more? The upper 10%. So we live in this kind of inequality. And I've come to think of it, my son's a physician, and he actually helped me understand this better, as a kind of referred pain. That, you know, the when people have an injury in their internal organs, the brain can't always figure out that that's where exactly it's coming from. So it picks some part of the body of the outside of your body that shares the sensory nerves, and it says there it is. So you might have a pain way, you might have an injury and inflammation way back in your jaw, and you might feel it as neck pain, or shoulder pain. And whereas if you get something in your stomach, that comes up as neck pain. And I think that that's a really good analogy to understand why people are feeling this. We feel the inequality of the effects of it in our families. We feel it, you know, in our insecurity about our kids' futures. But it doesn't stem from there. It stems from these changes in the economic and political life that we're going through. And you know, this tremendous inequality to the point that three economists, you know, at banks recently said back in 2015, they said, we now live in a plutonomy where about half of consumer spending is dictated by the top 10% of the population. And they were doing it just to tell people where they should invest. Yeah. Which is not to invest in the cheap mass production, but in these things like homes and special experiences, things that can't be mass produced and that therefore have increased at a rate of inflation way above the normal rate. So that's what I think people are struggling with. How do our families relate to that?
Indeed, indeed.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is KPFK 90.7 FM, The Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Maria Hall here with my co-host, Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with Professor Stephanie Kuntz about her latest book, which is called For Better and Worse, The Complicated Past and Challenging Future of Marriage. So, Stephanie, are there differences in marriage rates by race and ethnicity? And if so, why do you believe that's the case?
Well, let's start with the differences by class, because those race and ethnic differences are very much accustomed to that, but with the added stresses of prejudice. One of the things that we found, I've talked about the fact that people are having lower divorce rates if they do marry, but one of the big catch is this, that people who move in together expecting with the intention of marriage, and the cohabitant, most marriages begin as cohabitation now, but most cohabitations don't end in marriage. And there is this huge class difference between them. And the last 10, 15 years have seen a declining number of the low-income couples who enter cohabiting relationships who then go on to marry, whereas it's been pretty steady for the ones who are economically secure. And I think it's pretty obvious that if we go back to what we talked about at the beginning, that we have higher aspirations for marriage. Well, the higher aspirations means that you need more negotiation, you need to have more patience, you need to connect with each other in ways, especially in two-income families. You know, in the old household economy, everybody was working for the same thing, but now you go off to different places, you have different experiences, different risks, different rewards. So reconnecting as a couple, it takes a lot more work than it used to do, and it has to be more equal than it used to be. And that's stressful enough with all the old habits of marriage from the past, but it's particularly bad when you're facing the stresses of economic scarcity or just time scarcity even. Recent studies have shown that newlywed couples, black, white, and everything else, who have pretty good relationships, negative communication patterns and fights are more closely related to economic stress than they are to family of origins problems, or even just how good their general relationship is. These kind of stresses just really tear families apart. And for Native Americans and Blacks, it's even worse. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if you look at the way The inequalities that Black Americans face, the Native Americans. Black Americans have the lowest marriage rates. Native Americans have the highest divorce rates. And I think both are related to the fact that the economic discrimination, the job discrimination, the insecurity. But I think that perhaps for Native Americans, it's also the trauma of all of those years of the boarding schools and the taking people away from their families and their elders. But for my mind, the best way to understand the differences is this wonderful study that was made of divorce rates and marriage rates in the Army. And they found that that's the only place in America where Blacks and whites get the same wages, they go to the same schools, they have the same housing. And they found that the divorce rates were actually lower for Blacks there, and the marriage rates were the same. And that it was really important that they had the possibility, and this is with all our arguments about DEI today, the fact that there were actually opportunities for advancement helped, I think, to make it more possible for people to see that future and to have that confidence that allows you to do what we need to do with modern marriages.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stephanie, we're getting near the end of the show, and I want to make sure we don't lose this question when time runs out. So how do people, is your book for sale now everywhere, for better and worse, The Complicated Past and Challenging Future of Marriage? Any bookstore or Amazon, how do people get a hold of that? And also, how do they keep track of your writings?
Well, it's available from Viking, Penguin, or Amazon, or hopefully your local bookstores. Okay. I do have a website, stephaniekuntz.com, that people can look at.
It's C-O-O-N-T-Z. Stephanie Kuntz.
C-O-O, yeah, not a K with a C.
C-O-O-N-T-Z, yes. All right, that's good. And this, perhaps the last question, we'll see what time allows. But it's a very ambitious book. What was the hardest part, do you think, of writing the book? Did you find, and well, what was the most fun?
Well, the most fun were finding things out, like all of these differences, or the fact that the word Mrs., which is a feminist I once thought was a thing from patriarchy, but actually the putting of the Mrs. in front of a woman's name in patriarchy simply meant that she was a woman, a mistress, someone you looked up to, whether she was married or not. Wow. So famous woman who hadn't married would be called Mrs. because she was a mistress, just to the equivalent of master. Those sort of things are fun to find out. The hardest part is trying to write it in a way that is sympathetic and not demeaning to the people who do believe in this this nostalgia. I think that I was too dismissive of nostalgia in some of my early books, and I tried really hard in this work to explain how we got here and why it's not irrational for people to have these feelings, but how we might be able to transfer it to the real object of what is bothering them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, we do have time, I think, for another question. I know you want to. No, I think you're hearing that's it, 30 seconds to think. Well, my goodness. Well, we got it all in, or we got almost everything, and we wanted to get in. Stephanie Kuntz, we thank you so much for your work and for joining us today on the Lawyers Guild show and sharing some of that with us. We urge people to buy your book, check your website. It's a fascinating way to look at an old institution like marriage. That's for sure. And we thank you for doing so and for joining us. Until next week, same time, same place. This is Jim Lafferty along with Bria Hall thanking you for listening today, urging you to join us again next week. And in the meanwhile, be sure to stand up for your rights, my friends.
Mark your calendars. KPFK Summer Fun Drive officially kicks off on Tuesday, July 21st. We want to keep this drive as short as possible and get right back to the uninterrupted, commercial-free programming you love. But we can only do that with your immediate support. Shorten the drive today. Call 818-985-5735 and press option 2. That's 818-985-5735, option 2. Or skip the phone lines and give securely online right now at kpfk.org/donate. Your radio station, your voice. Keep it strong. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Ian Masters, the host of Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org and heard on KPFK Mondays through Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. Background Briefing looks into three or four of the important stories and issues of the day to provide an in-depth daily briefing with context, history, and insight from the best-informed guests closest to the scene, who offer analysis and details often overlooked by the soundbite-driven media more and more controlled by Trump-friendly oligarchs. So if you want facts and information to inform a motivated majority to save our democracy before it's stolen next November, tune in Mondays to Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. for your Background Briefing here on KPFK 90.7